Succession number 21563, Reel 1.
This is Ian Grant, Reel 1. And Ian, we'd be very interested to know something about your life before the war. Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in London, of all places. Considering my Scottish heritage, that was most unfortunate on my wife and my mother's part. However, at the age of 3, we moved to Singapore, where we lived for 5 years.
And were you in Singapore? Was it your father's job?
Yes, my father got a job in Singapore. He had been in the First World War, of course, and then he joined the Indian Army after the First War and spent his time hopping up and down places like the Khyber Pass, being pursued by angry gentlemen down the hills. And then, of course, as always happens, the politicians decided they could economise on the armed forces, and in 1922 he left under one of these economy drives and became a chartered accountant. This is how he went out and got a job in Singapore.
What are your memories of life in Singapore? That would have been an interesting era, wouldn't it?
Yes, indeedy. That was sort of 1926 to 31. And in those days, of course, people who were employed out there spent 4 years there and then got 1 year's leave because it took a month either way on a ship to get back to the UK. Unfortunately, 1931-32 was a bad time. My father was on leave in Scotland, where we were living, and he lost his job. So thereupon, he had to look around in the middle of the Depression for a job as a chartered accountant, which he did. And we wound up in Bishop Stortford, where I went to the local minor public school, Bishop Stortford College, until just after the declaration of war.
Did you have any brothers and sisters, Ian?
My brother was born in Prestwick in Scotland in 1933. And he eventually became a doctor when he lived in the United States for the last 30 years. So there we are. There I was, 16, when war was declared. And I eventually joined the Air Force through Glasgow University Air Squadron. Then 41.
You were at Glasgow University.
Yes.
You went straight on to university. Yes. What were you studying there?
Being Glasgow, mechanical engineering, so it was. my father had been to Glasgow as a training as a doctor before he got caught up in the First World War, so he was a trainee doctor, professional soldier, and chartered accountant, all rolled up in one.
Well, what is your... You were saying you were 16 when war started. Mm. Well, what is your memory of the outbreak of war? Did it mean much to you as a 16-year-old?
Well, I was with a small school party on holiday, a school holiday, on a houseboat on the Norfolk Broads, when we heard Mr. Chamberlain declare war. And we all hopped in the back of this schoolmaster's Rolls Royce with a dicky seat at the back and roared off back to Bishop Stortford to be reunited with our families. So, I joined the Air Force in 41 for pilot training.
Why did you join the Air Force? Was it your sort of engineering course that led you to that, you know, and the fact that you could join...
Well, I really don't know. I didn't like the sea, and I didn't fancy marching around on my flat feet all the time, so I thought the Air Force would be the better option.
Yes. And you've had this bit of training at Glasgow University.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, what did that consist of? You know, was it useful training?
Yes, well, it was a mixture of mechanical engineering and Air Force stuff.
You were sort of cadets, were you?
Yes, we were cadets, and it took the place of an initial training wing, which most people went through, but you went through University Air Squadron and did the ITW syllabus there. So apart from knowing how to rivet ships together and tensile strengths of bars of steel, we learnt something about the Air Force as well.
When you joined, did you volunteer or was it a call up?
No, I volunteered. Volunteered.
And that was in 1941?
41, yeah. They do tell you never volunteer in the services, but I did. So eventually we went through a grading school in Leicester, near Leicester, where you did 12 hours flying on a Tiger Moth to see if you had two left feet or two left hands or could keep an aeroplane in the air. After that, off to Canada, to Alberta.
So what sort of group did you go to Canada with? Would it have been a training squadron or something?
Well, it was the Empire Pilot Training Scheme was a huge organisation that I don't think has been given enough publicity. You either went to Canada or you went to the United States under the US Army or the US Navy or South Africa. The idea was, of course, the weather in these places was so much better for flying training. And UK was a little bit crowded at that time. So I pitched up in this place called Red Deer, which is halfway between Calgary and Edmonton. And did all my flying training there. Got my wings.
What planes were you training on?
A thing called a Stearman, which is a biplane, single engine, followed by Airspeed Oxfords, which were the twin engine airplane. Then back across Canada to Prince Edward Island, Charlottetown, where we did a known as a general reconnaissance course, preparatory to go joining Coastal Command. So I was able to recognise all the Japanese ships and the Japanese fleet, at least on a piece of paper, and the German ships. Then, after a hard 4 weeks in New York, off to Nassau in the Bahamas. King George paid my tourist fare around all these places, and we spent 6 months in Nassau.
What were you doing there?
Converting onto long-range liberators. I got there 2 or 3 days after a fellow called Sir Harry Oakes was murdered. This was quite a cause célèbre in its day. And Sir Harry Oakes was found murdered in his bed. He was an American millionaire who found Kirsten Lake gold mine in Canada. But he fell out with some of the local gentlemen known as the Bay Street Robbers. Bay Street being the main street of Nassau. And most of the Bahamians in those days were considered to be descendants from rum runners and booze runners from during the Prohibition era. However, a fellow called Count de Marini, who had married his daughter, was had up for this murder. And he obviously hadn't done it, because here was Harry Oakes, murdered in his bed, and his head bust in with a car jack handle, and the bed was set on fire. Now, this was not a sophisticated Frenchman's method of doing it, so obviously it was one of the local boyos who had been hired to do it, and was probably fed to the sharks within 6 hours. Anyway, de Marini had also fallen foul of our Governor-General of those days, the Duke of Windsor, God bless him, who was an idiot of the first water. And de Marini was found innocent, but was found to be persona non grata and shipped out of Nassau. I have read his book since, which he wrote at the age of 80 when everybody else was dead, and it's very interesting, and it did confirm some of our suspicions of what went on. However, that was Nassau.
Yeah, you were saying about the Duke of Windsor. You didn't seem to have much respect for him. What was going on regarding the Duke and Duchess of Windsor in Nassau?
Well, he had been parked out there by the rest of the royal family to keep out of trouble. He didn't. One of the sights in Nassau Harbour now and again was a very posh steam yacht belonging to a Swedish gentleman called Axel Werner Gren, who was known to be the money launderer for the Nazi Party in South America. And this was one of his chums. He did pick some weird friends, as we well know from his earlier history in Germany, with Adolf and his merry men. Unfortunately, I think the nicest thing to be said about the Duke of Windsor is he was a spoilt child. And this lady got hold of him and wound him round her little finger. However...
Were they much in evidence? You know.
Oh, yes, yes. The one thing I can remember is every function they turned up to, we had to stand smartly to attention to two national anthems, the British one and the American one, in her honour. Howsoever, that was Nassau, and it was good fun, and... then eventually back via New York on the Queen Mary. Christmas 43 we were at sea on the Queen Mary, and she was rolling like a drunk. We left New York, two destroyers accompanied us, but they couldn't stay at the same speed as the old girl who batted along at about 28 knots. And we wound up at Gourock. There were 16,000 people on the Mary, most of them American servicemen, and a few RAF people such as myself. There were 18 of us in what had been a single cabin. And we had these fold-down bunks from the wall, three deep. On every wall had three bunks on it. However, it was interesting as we left New York Harbour to hear the British staff captain come on the public tannoy to advise everybody, this is a British ship run by a British crew, and we trust you have a pleasant voyage, which advised most of the Americans who thought it was an American ship that it wasn't.
Yes, could I ask you, before we go on now, to your war postings in Britain, a little bit more, you know, about your experience in these places. In, for instance, in Canada, Red Deer, this area, what sort of training establishment was that?
Well, it was part of this enormous Empire training scheme. There were probably about 30 RAF stations in Canada, of which this was one. They were all the way along the railway from Montreal to Calgary. Swift Current, Medicine Hat, North Battleford, all lovely names like that, in Saskatchewan and Manitoba. And we were in Alberta, where it got very cold in the winter. I think 60 degrees of frost was the coldest I experienced. You had to walk around in pairs and watch one another in case your nose went white. And we had special hats with ear flaps on, so you could cover your ears up.
Did that hinder the flying at all? You know, the fact that there was so much ice and frost?
When it got very cold, yes, because these Oxfords particularly had to be hand-started by these poor airmen who sort of stood on the wing of the aeroplane and wound the starting handle round, and we did our best to get the engine to fire without blowing them off the wing. It was a filthy job, really.
Were there advantages in sort of training in that terrain to your later experience, would you say?
Well, the great advantage here, of course, was the weather is much more stable than it is here. You could expect it to be fine most of the time. I tried to get there a few years ago, but only got as far as halfway across the Rockies. I never got back to Calgary.
Did Did you receive a lot of hospitality from the Canadians?
Oh, indeed. They were great. And it was the same in New York. There was a woman there called Gretchen Green who was awarded the MBE in the end. She ran a sort of a club. And RAF personnel there were quite rare, so we didn't flood the place. But I found myself spending weekends with the next-door neighbours of Eleanor and Franklin D. Roosevelt up the Hudson. They were the next-door neighbours. The next-door estate, there was Hyde Park and there was Rhinebeck. And we had a lovely time. I can remember two old ladies running a cocktail party for the Air Force. And they were real southern ladies. And we had this weird drink with sprigs of mint sticking out of it. And we didn't really know what it was, but we got there at 6 and left there at 7. And when we hit the fresh air outside, these mint juleps got up and bit us. And I thought, these dear old ladies, you know, got us as drunk as fiddler's monkeys. They really did. Another place I stayed at, well, I remember it was in East 72nd Street, and this woman was a widow of an American diplomat. And she had a duplex apartment halfway up this huge skyscraper. And we had a butler. And he used to come and bring us breakfast in bed in the morning. And we used to stagger back from some nightclub at 2 in the morning, get in the elevator that went straight up to our bedroom level, so nobody heard us arrive, until we were woken up by the butler about 9 o'clock in the morning. This was really high living. And we met some terribly well-known people. Ruth Draper and her son, Paul, who was an interpretive dancer, I think. And she, of course, was on various stage shows. So for 4 weeks, we led the high life, then got on the Queen Mary and came back to Earth very rapidly.
And Nassau, what were the training facilities there like?
There were two airfields there. One, we started off on B-25 Mitchells. And the other field, Windsor Field, was the Liberators. We were crewed up then, you see. You had a full crew, and you stayed with them till you got to the squadron.
Right. What was a crew of a Liberator then?
11 men, 2 pilots, flight engineer, 2 navigators, 4 radio radar men and air gunners, and 3 straight air gunners. So it was quite a big crew. In today's Air Force, in the Nimrods, they've got exactly the same number. I think they've got 12 people in a crew.
We're talking of a very big plane, are we?
Oh, yes, it was a biggish aeroplane. It was one which closed the gap in the North Atlantic by being based in Ireland, Iceland, and Newfoundland, and the gap in the middle of the Atlantic, where the U-boats had been having fun for a couple of years, was closed up quite quickly. And the U-boat menace thereupon retreated to the Bay of Biscay and the French ports there. So that, I think, as time goes by, the Battle of the Atlantic will be found to have been the key to eventual victory, because up to that time the losses of ships and the supplies were enormous.
By the time you got back, was the Battle of the Atlantic still going?
No, it sort of was diminuendoing then, and the Bay of Biscay was the active area. We had, our Liberators had then been fitted with a searchlight called a Lee light under a wing commander. Sammy Lee had invented this gadget, which all maritime aircraft carry to this day. And this was used down the Bay of Biscay, which was kind of unfortunate. Well, by this time the U-boats had decided they'd shoot back. So all we did was illuminate the centre of the bullseye when coming into the attack by switching this light on. All they had to do was shoot at the light in the dark. So it was very handy, otherwise they wouldn't have seen us. However, D-Day was looming.
And yes, we're now back in Britain.
We're back in Britain, yes. Having got off the Queen Mary. And
yes. So if you could take me through the events now, sort of landing back in Britain, fully trained in, you were a pilot,
yep.
Is that right?
With a crew.
Yes, and you had done a lot of reconnaissance as well as, you know, this came into your flying.
Well, not a lot. We had worked up down the American Eastern Seaboard whilst training. And there was a lot of activity there with U-boats.
Yes, this would be interesting to ask you about that.
Yeah.
The American Eastern Seaboard.
Yes.
Yes.
Because a lot of their supplies were coming out of the United States and going around South Africa to the Far East. And also Nassau was on the ferry run with British aircraft bought from America, flying out to the Middle East. They used to fly down the West Indies along to Recife, the furthest east point in Brazil, and then across via Ascension Island to West Africa, and then across the west of Africa to the sunny Sudan, and then up north to Cairo. And there were a lot of aircraft went through that way.
So this was a really active area you
were
training in.
Oh, yes.
Yes, that's important, isn't it? Because you were getting experience of action as well as, you know, your training.
Indeed.
Mm. This Eastern Seaboard, you know, that with the U-boats.
Yes, so they sat along the Eastern Seaboard. They were waiting for the convoys to go by. And, of course, this is where this wonderful story of the Bermuda Triangle started off. Which is a load of old codswallop, really. But there was a formation of American aircraft on a training exercise, got lost, and pitched up in the water, were never seen again. And this was all put down to the magic effect of the Bermuda Triangle. All it was, really, was they couldn't navigate properly.
Right. So here we are, back in England in 1943.
And 43, that's right. And having passed through the various waiting stages in Harrogate, I was transferred to Northern Ireland to learn to fly on B-17 Flying Fortresses, of which there were two squadrons in Coastal Command, both of them based at that time in the Azores. In typical Air Force fashion, they trained me up on the B-17 and then said, oops, dearie, they're coming back to this country and they are going to convert onto Liberators. Would you go back to Liberators, please? So that we did. And I eventually joined the squadron in March 44 at St. Ethel in Cornwall.
St.
Ethel, E-V-A-L. It's still there, all deserted. And St. Morgan is the big airfield right next to it that the Americans were building at the time we were there. And from St. Ethel, there were operations down the Bay of Biscay until the big D-Day push.
And were you on these operations? The
yes.
Yes. Could you tell me about a sort of typical operation that you would do into that area?
Well, you were usually given a patch of sea to patrol. We had very advanced radar. And if you picked up anything coming into the French ports or going out from the French ports, the idea was to sink them if you could. As I say, we had this Lee light, which was there, I suppose, really to identify the target more than find it, because the radar found it. We had a wonderful setup in these aircraft with an electric autopilot. And when attacking, the navigator down in the front had a special repeater scope with bomb sights on it, and he actually flew the aeroplane on automatic pilot by making it go left and right. Luckily, the pilots had the main on-off switch and the altitude switch. And we used to attack from 50 feet, which was very low. This horrifies the modern Air Force a bit. But 50 feet it was, unless you thought it was a ship with masts a bit bigger than 50 feet and you came in a bit higher.
You were quite a target, I imagine, weren't you, for well-armed ships?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. If they spotted you, if they could see you. Only switch the light on a mile out, I may say.
Yes, this would have been in the dark, mainly.
Oh, usually in the dark, yes. The main tactic in those days was to try and attack a U-boat up a moon path, with the moon up there, and you could have the reflection in the water, which, of course, would show his silhouette up, and he didn't know you were there.
And how successful were you? Did you make many hits?
No. Not a thing. All I did was make the numbers up. Yeah, I saw them all after VE Day. They all popped up all over the place, flying black flags and sticking two fingers up to us.
I suppose it's not easy, though, is it? You know, to identify and actually hit something in.
Right, because by this time they had started fitting snorkels, whereby they could breathe through this pipe and run on diesel engines under the water. And whilst our radar could pick up a snorkel up to about 20 miles, it was a lot more difficult than a surface submarine. So our next task was to bottle up the English Channel.
And this would have been with the D-Day.
D-Day and subsequently, because you can imagine, if any U-boats had got mixed up with the invasion fleet, there would have been murder. So we successfully stopped any U-boats getting into the channel by going on the milk run backwards and forwards and backwards and forwards from Ushant to Land's End and the Lizard to Roscoff, I seem to remember. We did see six E-boats come out in formation one day, and we reported this back to Plymouth. They got terribly agitated, and the next thing we saw as we went round the milk run was 50 bow fighters going over the top. And when we came back to Roscoff, there was only a few bits of wreckage in the water, so obviously they had blown them straight out the water. Six E-boats amongst the invasion fleet would also have been kind of unfortunate.
Sort of obvious was, you know, when you were doing your protection, the invasion fleet.
They were too far away.
Were they?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, we were only 500,000 feet, you see, and they were maybe 50 miles east of us. But we were sealing up the mouth of the channel, basically. It was our job. So after D-Day and the invasion proceeded, I think, and about August that year, we moved up to Lucas in Scotland, near Dundee.
On D-Day itself, were you active?
Oh, yes. Yeah, we all went on the milk run, a 20-minute spacing between aircraft. Round and round and round we went, making sure that nothing got up the channel.
All day?
Mm.
All day and all night?
24 hours round the clock it was.
And you reckon that was 100% successful, do you? That E-boats
didn't. It seems to have been. There's been no history of any form of waterborne interference with the invasion fleet.